Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series, exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and by extension Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Cantelars, I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. Today we'll be exploring the amazing life of Professor Chennapati Jagadish, and in doing so we'll be digging a little deeper into the relationship between Australia and India and where that relationship might go in the years ahead. Professor Jagadish is an ANU Distinguished Professor in Electronic Materials Engineering and President of the Australian Academy of Science. And with me in the studio, and keen to gain some fascinating insights from this inspirational scientist, is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities. Professor Chennapati Jagadish, you came to the ANU's Electronic Material Department when it was brand new in the 1990s. Why?
So the great opportunity to be able to join a great university like Australian National University and also a new department, that means there's a lot of potential for growth and be able to establish the research programs and facilities. That's what really excited me to come to ANU from Canada.
So you work in the research field of semiconductor optoelectronics. In layman's terms, what's that research about and what practical impact does that have potentially on all our lives?
So the optoelectronics is conversion of light into electricity in the case of the solar cells and photodetectors, and also conversion of the electricity into light, for example, lasers and LEDs. Okay. So some of the lasers which we have developed are nowadays used in optical fiber communications, and now they are the backbone for internet, for example. And LED technologies which are used for the LED light bulbs, my students have been manufacturing millions of LEDs in China, for example, and then these LEDs are used in light bulbs.
So it's being used more and more in everyday appliances.
Absolutely. And again, you know, high efficiency solar cells, which are used in satellites, for example, again, made out of the semiconductors, which we work on. And so at the moment, also, we are using these semiconductors, split water to generate hydrogen as the next generation energy source and a clean energy source as well.
Wow. And you're also an expert in nanoscience and nanotechnology. How is this work likely to impact on humanity in the future?
So the nanotechnology is seen as the technology of the future, and nanotechnology has got a huge impact in many industry sectors, including from electronics and photonics and communications and healthcare and even detection of diagnosis of diseases as well as treatment, and including the energy and environment as well. So really, nanotechnology is a broad-ranging technology covering a broad spectrum of research, which will have a huge impact on the society.
Can I just ask, Jagadish, we've just this week had the release of the Parliamentary Joint Committee report from the Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security on foreign interference into universities. And, you know, as a group of universities which undertakes a significant proportion of all research, but also a significant proportion of sensitive research, there's been this issue about dual use technology and how we actually identify that. And so I'm just wondering, with the research that you are a leader in this country and internationally, is there any concern around misinterpretation of that, both from a policy perspective, but also from a kind of security defence perspective?
Thanks, Vicky, for that question. And it's an important question. And really, every technology one can really look at as dual use technology, but we have got the systems to manage these sorts of security issues or otherwise potential of misuse of the technologies which we are developing. And again, science is a very global endeavor, and it is important for us to be part of the global players and also work with students and postdocs coming from various parts of the world, because they are the driving force for research in our country. But at the same time, you know, we can also manage any of the risks which have been identified by various entities like intelligence agencies or so. But we have done that one for over 30 years or so. I do not see that as a major problem. And most of these students also want to stay back in our country, Vicky. And if you can really provide long-term opportunities for them in terms of long-term visas and also create employment opportunities in the country, they can stay back and contribute to our economy and our society as well, including developing new technologies which are critical for the country's future.
Ron, there's a whole nother podcast actually about retaining our talent, as Jagadish has just referred to, in terms of the PhD students who want to come and study here. We have cases of some students who are waiting 12 months still for a visa, and we're losing that. And we've talked about this previously. We're losing that technology. But I know we want to get on to also your background, but I'd be really interested to pursue that as a further discussion, because I think it's an important one.
So absolutely, Vicky. Just to give an example, and we got the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence on Transformative Meta-Optical Systems. So these are the technologies which we are developing for the next generation of holograms coming out of our phones, and then also Li-Fi, like equivalent to Wi-Fi, using light rather than wireless. Wow. And in order to develop those technologies, we need people. So just to give an idea, some of the students from India, and whom we consider as a close ally and a partner, and waiting for more than 18 months. I keep on getting requests every week asking me to do something. And we have raised this issue at the highest levels of the government, including with the Prime Minister, when I met with him as President of the Australian Academy of Science. And he understands the importance of fast-tracking some of these visa processing. And particularly if we identify some of our countries are allies, and we should not really delay this visa processing. And if you delay that one, and then essentially what's happening is that we are slowing down in our progress to develop the technologies which are critical for this country.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's a great way to segue to another issue that Vicky and I wanted to pursue. And as a result of your life's work, you're now a Companion of the Order of Australia, a remarkable achievement for a person who studied in front of a kerosene lamp while growing up in a remote Indian village. For many Australians, it's a remarkable and little known story. Do you think that your story and some of those other things that you were talking about highlight just how little Australians really know about India?
So, Ron, this is a really important point. You know, I mean, there are lots of bright people in various parts of the world, including in India. And then how do we really provide opportunities for them? As you know, that the education is really empowers people. And that's where Australia can play an important role in terms of educating people from various parts of the world, in particular India. And it really surprises me, having been here in Australia for 32 plus years, and why the relationship between India and Australia is not stronger than which it should be, considering that we both are democratic countries and we have the same value systems and the multicultural societies. So really, you know, the opportunity for strengthening linkages between India and Australia are enormous. And only recently, people started acknowledging and realizing the value and importance of India in the region. And as you know, that India has become like a tech superpower, particularly in the IT areas or so. And that means our relationship with India need to be strengthened. And I'm really glad that most recently we have really signed the free trade agreement between both the countries. The potential is enormous. And particularly knowing that we want to really create a peaceful environment in the region and also prosperity to the people in this region. And India and Australia has a lot of potential to work together to strengthen those linkages.
What do you put that down to? I mean, why have we dropped the ball when it comes to a greater understanding between the two countries?
And partly, also potentially the historical reasons. And India has been part of the, is relied on, Soviet Union, for example, for some of the defense needs. And so that's where probably people have thought that Australia, we as a country are more aligned to the US, and that's probably India might have paid a price because of that perception. But the reality is that when you talk to the government of India, they say that, nobody else wanted to sell any weapons to us, and then we have to really have our own national security. And then Russia was a country which was willing to sell us the weapons, and that's why we end up going and collaborating with Russia. But now, of course, as you know, that the America has realized this, India has an important role to play in the region. And so, again, U.S. consider that India is a strategic partner to make sure that peace is prevailed in this part of the world.
And I guess that highlights then Australia's place in the region and the importance of our relationship with India, both from a geostrategic and political angle, but also from that research collaboration angle. You said all research is global, the best research is global. And the Australian government, there is literally a conga line of ministers travelling to India very shortly. I know the Treasurer is going, I'm travelling with the Education Minister, the Foreign Affairs Minister is going, the Assistant Trade Minister is travelling, and the Prime Minister are travelling. And I think that's all before the 9th of March, so literally in the next little while. But do you think, is it a little too late, or can we be more positive than that, because there are these huge shifts in sort of the geostrategic picture from our perspective?
My view, Vicky, is that nothing is too late, and particularly considering that India also looked towards the West, and now India is also recognizing the importance of the East, and that's where I think, you know, relationship between and Australia is going to play an important role in the region. And we're all delighted that, in fact, most interestingly, that on Monday evening, we had the visit of Minister for State External Affairs of India visiting in Sydney. And then he was mentioning that 8 federal ministers from India has visited Australia, indicating the importance of Australia in the relationship, in India's international relationship. So that means there's a desire from both the countries to really develop this relationship between India and Australia. One thing which we sometimes don't make use of the diaspora. Diaspora has an important role to play in strengthening the relationship between both the countries, because of the fact that the diaspora understands both the countries very well, because of the fact that they're born in one India and then now they're living in Australia. And then I always say this one, Vicky, that, you know, the diaspora are the ambassadors of India in Australia. And also when they go to India, they are the ambassadors for Australia. So thereby, both the countries, they can enable the relationship between both the countries as well.
But we do have to, you know, and it's interesting, I don't mean to be trite here, but it seems that we're moving away from this engagement with India as, you know, merely being about cricket and curry. But your background sort of says something maybe about the way in which we need to rethink our attitude towards academics more generally, because I noticed you've been a trailblazer. You came here as a young Indian scientist and you've done remarkable things here in Australia, and yet we don't seem to have a lot of Indians in senior research positions at our universities. Is that part of this problem?
So this is a challenge for us as a country. You know, I mean, why Indians go to US and then flourish? You know, for example, if you go and look at most of the big tech companies, you know, in Google CEO is from India, and Microsoft CEO is from India, IBM CEO is from India, I can go on the list. So we sometimes have the tendency to think that whether there is a cultural fit or not, but whereas the rest of the world doesn't care about whether there's a cultural fit or not, we need to be a bit more open-minded. And then bring people, those who got the right kind of skills, into the country, give them the opportunities, and again, acclimatize them to the Australian conditions, so thereby they can be able to provide the leadership. It's a missed opportunity if we really confine ourselves to say that people only stay at the bench level, and then there's a lot of potential for people from the developing countries, particularly countries like India, provide leadership within the country as well.
So does it say more about us or more about India or more about the relationship? And anecdotally, what we are often told in the university sector is that if we're looking at, say, students, for example, students will choose to go to a non-top 100 university in the US over coming to one of the, and all of the 8 universities that I represent are certainly in the top 100, but even coming to an Australian university. So I wonder, where is it that we haven't, to your point, trite as it may sound, have we focused on the cricket and curry and not really sold ourselves as a nation, which we are, of innovators, entrepreneurs, you know, nimble? We may be small, but we have areas of expertise. So is that on us? And then how do we shift, if that is the case, how do we shift that perception, I guess, of Australia as beyond beautiful beaches, which we've got, and all of those sorts of things, but, you know, that we've got world-class research and universities in this small country of 25 million people?
Oh, absolutely, Vicky. And certainly we need to go beyond the three C's of cricket, curry, and Commonwealth. And then also that we need to start looking at thinking beyond the transactional relationship to the long-term strategic relationship between both the countries. That's very important. And again, the perceptions in India also are a bit of a challenge because of the fact that we have had, you know, the bashings of the students in about 20 years back or so. And the residual effects of these things, perceptions are like, you know, we are a racist country and then, you know, are you safe or not? And in fact, even most recently, as even 5-6 years back, one of my students came and from India. And when I took her out for lunch, you know, we were waiting for an administrator to come back. And her first question was how her family was really worried. She's going to Australia. Is she safe?
Wow.
Mm. And I had to tell her, it is one of the safest countries in the world. And then having traveled and collaborated with people from 30 plus countries, and then I say that I can never imagine living in anywhere else other than in Australia because of the high quality of life and the safe country, multicultural country, and you know, a very friendly people. But that awareness is not there. So that's where we need to work towards enhancing the awareness about Australia and India through various, you know, people-to-people relationships, for example. And that is why my wife and I have started an endowment called the Chinnupati and Vidya Jagadish Endowment to open the doors for people from the developing countries, including India, so that they can come and experience Australia so that they can get a better exposure and an appreciation of the quality of life in Australia and then how friendly and how safe it is, so that it can open the doors for them. And then they see Australia is a place where they want to come and study, and also they want to make their lives by contributing to our society. So that certainly there's a more need for enhanced awareness within India about the innovative nature of Australia. That awareness is a bit missing, and we need to do a lot of work. And that's where also I tell the Indian diaspora that they have an important role to play, play as well in terms of taking the right messages back into India as well.
I want to touch on your fund, but in order to set that up, I just want to ask you a question. I mentioned before about the lack of Indians involved in high-end, you know, research positions. Do you think that over time in Australia, there's been a paternalistic sort of patronising attitude from Australia that has stopped some brilliant minds from your home country achieving all they could here in Australia?
So I would say that, of course, I've had many opportunities at Australian National University. As I said, it's a great university. And then I would never imagine, Ron, that you know, I become a president of the Australian Academy of Science in my wildest dreams, for example. So from my point of view, I have had many opportunities, and I'm most grateful for those opportunities. Having said that, I did not want to take up any of the administrative or leadership roles in the university sector because of the fact that I was not too sure how I will be accepted. And also by nature, I wanted to be closer to my science. Mm-hmm. And then particularly in terms of training students and postdocs and inspiring them, thereby they are making a difference to the world. So that has been my passion. So, but at the same time, there's more potential there also for our system to look at ourselves and then ask the question, why there's not much higher diversity within the country in terms of leadership positions? That's a question mark for us. So there's a lot to reflect on, and then also make sure that take some risks. See, typically we'll have a little bit of tendency of risk averseness. But in US, people want to take risk, and that's why people end up giving them the opportunities. And that is why, you know, people end up flourishing in these leadership positions. And we should really get out of this risk averseness attitude, and then encourage and willing to take the risk, and then give the opportunity to people, and then they may create wonders within the country, and particularly in the higher education sector as well.
Do you think that and we have actually talked about this in many other contexts about the risk-averse nature of Australia in a whole range of areas, but of course we're focused on research being the Group of Eight podcast. And even if, you know, we looked at countries like Israel, for example, they will take a risk in terms of funding projects, and they actually expect failure, because from failure comes success. And yet we don't have that same appetite for risk in terms of funding research. And so it really is a culture, it's a deeply embedded I think, cultural barrier for Australian researchers in many ways. We do have with the current Industry and Innovation Minister, Ed Husic, somebody who is really keen to push the barrow, I think, and I think he's also a bit frustrated at the slowness of, you know, industry policy. They've just announced the $15 billion National Reconstruction Fund, which is in the Federal Parliament now. But and as we said at the very beginning, we've got several ministers and the Prime Minister travelling. Do you think perhaps that there is now at least an opportunity for a greater appetite for risk in that innovation end of our research spectrum, notwithstanding the importance of basic research? And do you think there's an opportunity within the National Reconstruction Fund for us to exploit that?
Absolutely, Vicky. And in fact, these days I give a talk called Failures or Pathway to Success, sharing my own personal failures with the next generation to inspire them and then making them aware that you can learn from every failure. And then if you want to be successful in life, you should not be afraid of failures. This is for individuals and for us also as a nation as well. So I know that Minister Husic and we ended up talking quite a lot about these matters. And then he is very passionate about taking those risks and then acknowledge. And out of 10 things which we have really taken up, maybe half of them are successful and half of them are not. But if those half of them are they're paying off, and then you can recover all the things which you have invested on, which might have not led to outcomes which we are hoping for. If you go for risk-free research, that means you are really doing research very routine type and predictable research. And in fact, whenever my students come and tell me that, oh, a particular experiment didn't work, and I say it's good, they look at me and then say that, why are you saying good? My experiment didn't work. And then I always tell them that something didn't work means it makes us to think.
Yeah.
And then hopefully come up with a better experiment or the interpretation of why that didn't work. And then hopefully you'll be able to come up with innovative solutions to make that work as well.
I want to zero in on this idea of risk and the risk of bringing in students from outside to collaborate here in Australia in relation to Australian science. I noted one quote from an article written about you in which you said, we get a lot of interns coming from Europe and other countries and we're happy to host them. But whenever we get requests from developing countries, we automatically say no because of the fact they need support, financial support. Doesn't that say a lot about the way in which our attitudes need to change?
Absolutely, Ron. And so there's a lot of potential and there are a lot of bright people out there. We need to really provide opportunities for those individuals. And based on the success of our endowment, I'm pleased to say that the Australian National University has created a future research talents program and targeting particularly India and Indonesia. And then this year, we are expecting more than 80 students coming from India, 20 students coming from Indonesia, covering a broad spectrum. So as a nation, we can create these sorts of the internship programs and try to attract some of the brightest people. And if you go and look at US, for example, and they try to attract the brightest people anywhere in the world, and then they are the ones, the driving force for lots of companies in the Silicon Valley, for example. Not only they are smart, but they also have that hunger for success, fire in the belly. So that's what we want people, those who got smart as well as also fire in the belly, so that they can come and then create the wonders within our country in terms of innovation space, startup companies, and also contributing to existing industries as well.
And is that why you and your wife established the Chenapati and Vidya Jagadish Fund? And can you tell us how that operates?
Yeah, so basically, we get a lot of requests from developing countries. And so I intentionally, we both my wife and I have decided that instead of targeting just India just because we started our lives in India, in fact, we need to be much more broadly thinking. Anybody from the developing countries, they can come and join us. And the less opportunities they have in their own countries, it's a big step for them, coming to a state of a great university like ANU and be able to access state-of-the-art equipment and then be able to work with some of the leading experts in their fields. And it really can inspire them and also that can open the doors for them. Either they can, if they've really impressed their supervisors, they can come back as a PhD students and then continue their research here. And if not, wherever they want to go somewhere else, And these people can act like references for them, which can also open the doors for them as well. So some of the early batch of our endowment students, some of them have gone to Caltech and MIT and Cornell and Georgia Tech and some of the top universities in the world. And only thing which I ask them to do is that whenever they become really big, they should also try to help other people. So thereby we can really encourage this circulate this culture of giving. So thereby the society is in a better shape.
We obviously need more people like you. You talked about diaspora, but we need more people like you to actually, frankly, put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
And promote that sort of research, that sort of forward giving, if you like. Can I just ask, how many PhD students are you supervising at the moment?
So, Vicky, my pride and joy has been not about my papers and awards and all the recognitions and my PhD students and postdoctoral fellows. I had the pleasure and honor of supervising 60 plus PhD students.
Wow.
And then also 50 plus postdoctoral fellows. And currently we got in my group about 12 students are doing their PhDs with us. And then in fact, we are waiting for half a dozen of them for the last 18 months or so. And in fact, some of them, we lost them to other universities like Manchester University and other parts of the world. And that is where it is really important we really process these visas for students as soon as possible, so that they can come and then join us in developing the technologies for the future of our country.
For those who don't know, sorry, Ron, to interrupt, but for those who don't know, that's an incredible amount of people that you have supported over their career and their lifetime. And Jagadish is so right. It is a real problem in terms of the visa processing. Now, some of the visas will be delayed for security issues, you know, some of the reasons we don't know. I guess what we're saying to government, and I've said it just recently in the media in the last week or so, is if you're going to make a determination, at least make it quickly.
Mm.
Because you have students hanging on for, you use the cited an example of 18 months, and that's through a centre of excellence that the Australian government is funding. So you've kind of got one arm of government not talking to the other arm of government, you know, surprise, surprise, and we lose this capability.
Yeah.
So, Vicky, we are really shooting ourselves in the foot by not really processing these visas. That means, you know, we are missing the opportunity to develop these technologies in the name of security issues.
Exactly.
And what are you really securing if you're not really able to develop the technologies which are important for our country? So we really need to really address this as a priority. Particularly when you say that, you know, India is a strategic partner for us and then we are part of Quad, and that means, you know, when we should be able to process these visas within 2 weeks or so rather than waiting for 18 months. In fact, the student who has gone to Manchester University asked me, can you really give me a letter stating that I have been waiting for 18 months for Australian visa, because otherwise people will look at me and then say that I got a gap in my CV.
Yeah.
People will ask me, what did you do after finishing your master's? And then you started your PhD for 18 months. What did you do? Waiting for Australian visa. It's an embarrassment, but I provided the letter and encouraged him, wished him well. So they really need to act this one with a priority because of the fact that we want to become like a knowledge-based economy. We want to be a smart country. We need to have smart people in our country. And it is important for us to really, you know, minimize any hurdles we create for these people to come into our country, be able to contribute to our society.
Jagadish, the work that you do with PhD students and the work you do with the fund is all about giving back. Take us back to your early days in that Indian village, because it's a great way to wrap this conversation up about the possibilities that exist for people when they get a chance and they've got support from various mentors. Take us back to those early days in the Indian village that led you to this position that you have now here at the ANU.
So, Ron, I started my life in a very small village in India, and I studied in front of a kerosene lamp till I finished my year 7. And then I lived with my maths teacher in a neighboring village because there was no high school in my village. I'm grateful to two of my high school teachers. Without their help in my high school, probably I'll be plowing the fields in India today. So really, many people have helped me in my life, and particularly high school students really transformed my life. And so that's what, you know, is important. You know, I tell people, if a boy from a small village who studied in front of a kerosene lamp can become the distinguished professor of physics at the Australian National University, can become the president of the Australian Academy of Science, it's the sky is the limit for the next generation. And how do we create the environment for next generation to be successful? And I think all of us have an important role to play, particularly the governments have an important role to play in terms of facilitating and creating more opportunities for these bright young people.
On that inspirational note, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Jagadish, for your time. It's amazing listening to your story. And thank you so much for taking part in this podcast.
Okay. Thank you, Ron and Vicky. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.